It used to be an article of faith that you didn't even have to ask out loud. It was automatic. The elected leaders of our country, whether House, Senate, or President, obviously are going to prioritize American interests above those of any other country. We have allies. We have friends. We have people that we have common cause with, et cetera. But at the end of the day, everything has to be subordinate to the United States. That's the way it used to be. Now then, you cannot take that at face value. You have to ask the hard questions, because there is increasing evidence that America is not the priority for a lot of these people. It is the greenback. It's not even another country per se. We're going to get into that in a minute. But really, it's about access to power. It's about money. And it's about satisfying their own desires. And by the way, America may not even be second or third. It might be somewhere last, even among those who claim to be America first. And to try to help us figure out a lot of this stuff, because somebody I know has been covering this very closely for many years, is the amazing Matthew Ho, senior fellow at Eisenhower Media Network, former State Department official and combat Marine. Matthew Ho, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Danny. Good to see you.
Well, listen, you know, as somebody who has served our country both in uniform and at the government level, and somebody who loved America, who was literally willing to put your life on the line for it, it should be an expectation that our politicians over our shoulders always had our back. Is that the case now, though? Do you feel that way? I can't hear you, by the way.
Sorry, I did that thing. I think I'm having microphone problems. Apologize to everyone, but I'll just pull it. If it keeps doing that, I'll switch to the other mic. I don't think it's ever been the case, Danny. I think politics have always served the political interests and not the interests of those who, you know, in our communities, in our society, but most especially in our military, who get sent abroad for these wars. I mean, look at LBJ knowing in 1964, 1965 that Vietnam was unwinnable, but still choosing to send hundreds of thousands of young men, tens of thousands who would never come home, hundreds of thousands that would come home physically and psychologically and spiritually maimed. And he chose to do it anyway because it was better politically. Right. And I think you've seen that over and over again. We saw that with the Obama administration. Barack Obama didn't believe in the escalation of that war, and he did it anyway because that was his best political choice, as he saw it. That's what David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel advised him. Hillary Clinton and Bill and Bob Gates, those weren't decisions made upon what's on the best national security interest for the United States or whether that war was winnable. Those were decisions that were made based upon what's best politically for the White House. And so we see that here, and now we have these absolutely revolting and despicable comments from the President of the United States regarding the four service members that were killed in Iraq and Jordan, saying that their dying wish was for the United States to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, and saying how he doesn't want to send them to their deaths, but he has to. You know, I'm reminded of Ted White's character in Caddyshack, Judge Smales, when he says to the caddy, Danny, you know, I've sent younger boys than you to the gas chamber. Didn't want to do it, but I felt I owed it to them, right? That degree of arrogance, that despicability, that entitlement to destroy others' lives for their own purposes, purposes that in this case aren't even clear. At least we can go with Obama's case or LBJ's case, where he did this. They escalate those wars because they feel it's in their best interests politically, that they'll lose elections if they are seen as weak. But in this case with Trump, we don't really even understand why he's doing it, as he seems to change right every day to day in terms of what this is all about, what it's for, what he's going to do, et cetera.
You know, I'm reminded of something that Joe Kent has said on our show. That while Joe Kent was still in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, that President Trump heard from all kinds of people, both intelligence community and the military community at the highest levels, that this war would not work, that it would cost us the Strait of Hormuz, that assassinating the leader wouldn't work, all those things. And yet, and Tucker Carlson actually said the same thing. He told him, he talked to him as recently as the 26th of February, and he said Trump acknowledged that the things weren't going to work and yet did them anyway. Well, right. I mean, I'm asking you to speculate here, but why would the president of the United States go down a path that even his advisors on the inside said was not going to work, even politically?
Again, this is not limited to this White House. I mean, we can go back, look at the Biden administration, look at their decisions with regards to, say, either supporting the genocide in Gaza or supporting Ukraine's war, against Russia, and just the things that were obvious to objective outside observers. The Biden administration chooses to support Israel's genocide in Gaza because they feel it's better to keep in the good graces of the Israel lobby than it is to, stand for human rights, stand against a genocide, and actually listen to the wishes of their voters. I mean, they're so lost in their clarity is so poor on this. Their self-interest in thinking that this is the best way to maintain not just the White House, but to maintain power is to stay in line with the Israel lobby, means that they rather lose the election to the Republicans than anger the Israel lobby. I mean, so there are aspects of this with power where Donald Trump may also be factoring in. He doesn't want to anger the Israel lobby. He wants to stay in the good graces of Miriam Adelson and Benjamin Netanyahu. But also, too, I think Donald Trump is famously ignorant. I don't think Donald Trump has a good conception of what's occurring here. I know Joe Kent has said that, this information was presented to him, but I'm wondering in how much and in what quantity and what was the scale and the scope of the positive information that was given to him. I mean, we know this story that Netanyahu David Barnea, the former head of the Mossad, comes to Washington, D.C. and give Trump a briefing in the White House Situation Room. And that's what puts him over the line. That's what makes him decide to carry out this war. I think there's also a lot of concern just about the quality of the information that the president's getting, what he's being told. And again, we've seen this before. This is not peculiar or unique to this administration. This is something that has impacted every administration. And again, we have our own personal experiences, you and I, Danny, with this in terms of the Afghan war. And if people don't know Danny's backstory, when Danny's on active duty and he comes back from Afghanistan, and he's been there for a year, and his position in Afghanistan had him all over the country, walking on foot patrols to attending General Petraeus's daily briefings. I don't know if anyone in that year had a better vantage point of what was occurring in Afghanistan than Danny did. And he comes back and he goes back to work on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he realized that all this information that's going up to the White House, that's going up to Congress, to senior decision makers, is just essentially lies that they're covering up what's actually occurring there. So if people don't know Danny's story, what Danny does is writes his own report using the information that he had available to him from his time in Afghanistan, as well as his position in the Pentagon. And he produces a report and he goes to Congress with it. And that Danny says the generals are lying about the Afghan war, and no one listened to him. A couple did, but most didn't.
You did, and that made me feel better.
I did, the point of telling that story is, one, so people understand who the host of the show is, but also, two, is to show that this is systemic. This is endemic. And maybe it's worse because of Trump and his own character, his own ego, the only thing loyal Donald Trump is to, the only thing that Donald Trump has any loyalty to is his own ego, is his own self-interest. I think that's what we have to understand, that the system is corrupt, that it's rotten, that there is an imperial inertia here, that there is profit in the sense of the military industrial complex, and that we have a system of organized bribery that groups like the Israel lobby can exploit. And that provides not just the pressure to ensure that the information going to the president that he acts upon keeps with the narrative, but it creates an ecosystem in Washington, D.C., where how could there be any other information going to the president than what those forces want there to be? And again, you can say that because this is consistent over the years. We can go back, stretch back, of course, to, again, LBJ in Vietnam. And so this is a very real problem, and it's a reason why the American empire will continue to wage wars like this.
Until it collapses on itself, because I think that this ecosystem, as you describe it very accurately, cannot be sustained. And let me just kind of point a couple of things out why I argue that very strongly here. So I'm going to show you a soundbite in a minute of Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about something that has happened in Congress yesterday, I think it was. In the context, though, it's important to, before she starts to speak, that people understand it is now clear, because as you pointed out a second ago, that we now know why Trump was talked into going to this war. It was against the advice of the intelligence community, our intelligence community, against the advice of our military members, against the advice of the vice president, about Tulsi Gabbard at the time, Joe Kent, and a number of others. He did it. He went ahead and did it anyway. And now then we see that it was because Benjamin Netanyahu wanted him to, and he thought it would work because of the assassination, all that kind of stuff. But now we see it was a spectacular failure. Nothing worked at all. It has now cost us, up to this point, 18 dead and about 500 wounded Americans, hundreds of billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. The 20 bases are continuing to be just dismantled by Iranian military. Our air defense missiles are running short. Our offensive missiles are running short. In short, and now all Americans are suffering because the Bab al-Mandab is closed as a direct result of all these passage. The Strait of Hormuz remains closed, etc. All of these spectacular failures because President Trump went to war on behalf of the Israeli side at profound cost to America. You might think, if you're a normal American, that now there would finally be this repudiation against this reflexive adherence to the state of Israel. And many American people are. That has not yet gotten to the top. And here, Marjorie Taylor Greene talks about the physical cost, what's happening now.
The NDAA vote, that's the National Defense Authorization Act. This is the bill that you've heard a lot about that contains Section 219, which is the actual merging of U.S. military intelligence, and also our defense supply chain, which is incredibly important. That's all types of contracts that build all types of weapons and equipment for our military. That Section 219 merges the United States military with the Israeli military. This is something that should never happen with any foreign country. It's a complete destruction to our sovereignty and is completely America last.
America last. I mean, I couldn't say it any better.
Right.
But make this make sense to me, Matt, and even if I don't like what you're going to say, with all of that wreckage I just described, why in God's name now would the United States Congress want to tie us even closer to the state of Israel, especially the IDF?
Because of the corruption, right? Because of the rot, because that we have a system of legalized bribery. We also have this ecosystem that we were talking about before. So this argument of legalized bribery of these members of Congress getting hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars from the Israel lobby, which is true for just about every other interest group and organization in this country. So it's not like the Israelis have their own special thing going here. This is the same thing that Big Ag exploits. This is the same thing that pharma exploits. This is the same thing, you know, that any industry is going to exploit. But that only goes so far. This ecosystem creates it in such that these people are true believers. So they do receive their talking points from the Israel lobby. They do receive guidance and direction as to how to vote and what to say. But many of them are in these positions as true believers. They actually do believe that an Israel first policy is the best policy for the United States of America. And there's multiple reasons from that. Some of them are imperialists or neoconservatives. Some of them are Christian Zionists. Some of them, this is just because what has been taught through American schools, American education, whether it's at the high school level, college level, graduate level, what the U.S. military, essentially embodies in terms of its relationship with Israel, what every think tank expert, with the exception of a handful in Washington, D.C., will testify as being in the best interests of the United States, certainly what the military-industrial complex likes. So you have this coming together then of these various views, understandings, philosophies, and they meet in a common point in the sense of integrating the U.S. military with Israel. And you have to, people have to remember too, that for the United States, Israel has always been an imperial project, a colonial project, if you will. The United States takes over from the British Empire. It's no secret. There's no argument that the state of Israel was a British colonial project meant, as the Governor General of Jerusalem said in the 1920s, to establish a loyal Jewish Ulster in the midst of a potentially hostile sea of Arabs. I mean, that's essentially what Israel becomes for the United States. You see that codified in the Nixon Doctrine, where the cops on the beat in the Middle East for the United States are Jewish Israel and Persian Iran, right? And then they're meant to contain that, the Arabs. So, you know, there's an inertia here. There's a reasoning here as well that has been well established in American circles, foreign policy, national security, military, intelligence for decades, that the United States and Israel are linked for not just for reasons of, that are supportive of Israel's priorities and objectives, but for American ones as well. So what you've had, though, is you've had since October 7th, 2023, an understanding of the American public of what Israel's actually like. The Hollywood tales of Israel having been established in, you know, in a land without people, you know, that whole line of a people without a land, land without people, and then embellished by American entertainment for decades, informing Americans on what Israel is like through movies and television shows and books. But then, too, you have as well this recognition of the genocide. People seeing on their phones every day Israel carrying out that genocide, murdering tens of thousands of children, maiming tens of thousands of more children, just the wholesale destruction of a society. And the American public, despite every attempt by the major corporate media and the vast majority of the American political establishment telling them otherwise, the American people understand the reality of Israel. And so that has turned American public opinion on support to Israel completely around. And so now, with the exception of the oldest Republicans, no American demographic group is supportive of aid to Israel, supportive military assistance to Israel. That makes then the annual voting of billions of dollars to Israel problematic for the American Congress. So this section 219 that integrates the American militaries, and it's very vast, and it's pretty vague the way it's written. And the key point is this establishment of an executive agent, essentially a czar, who can override and decide anything regarding Israel in military affairs, technology issues, eventually also will include intelligence as well, that with the exception of the Secretary of Defense and the President, this person will overrule anyone else in the U.S. government. And so what is the purpose of doing this, though, this way? It's to make it so that the American Congress doesn't have to vote anymore on providing support to Israel. It essentially insulates the Congress and the U.S. relationship with Israel from the will of the American people. And this is very key to understand that what we're up against here, it's not static. It's dynamic. This is a Leviathan, is an organism that is alive, and it reacts, and it understands, and it predicts. And it does things like this. So as people who are just joining this movement against this system, it's something you have to realize that whatever victories you may have, and I'll say we have had a huge victory in the last few years, need to provide credit to folks like you, Danny, and to Gary and other hosts like you all, other programs like you all, for informing the American people. And that had a real impact in turning the American public opinion on Israel around to where it rightfully should be. And so now what does the establishment do? What do the elites do? What does the empire do? Do they have to change, right? They have to modify. They have to insulate the Congress from the American public. And so you have this bill that essentially integrates the U.S. and Israel, the militaries, but it is very extensive. It's very deep. It touches on every aspect of the military-industrial complex. And then, of course, you have in the Senate a companion piece Tom Cotton's section 1217, I think it is, that does the same thing for intelligence, where if that is included in the NDAA, the United States will provide any intelligence to Israel of anything, whatever the Israelis want, they get. In order for the United States to, the United States intelligence community, to not provide a piece of intelligence to Israel under Tom Cotton's amendment to the NDAA, the President of the United States has to certify why and then go to Congress to
buy that. Do you know what Tom Cotton is saying is the justification for this? Why would he want to add that and to expand our connection intelligence-wise to Israel?
Cotton's a true believer.
And no, but what does he say? What is his justification?
Oh, I think it's just, you know, run-of-the-mill, you know, integration, dynamic times, fast-paced environment. The Israelis are the best of intelligence as we are. You know, we should be working together as closely as possible, you know, blah, blah, blah. Same thing that they are saying to defend Section 219, the integration of the militaries. You know, the Israelis are the best. Why wouldn't we want to, you know, be involved with them in this manner? And this makes more sense. It's more effective. It's, you know, economies of cost, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll look at the positive side first. You're right. Not just our channel and several others who have been telling the truth. And obviously you have been doing it for years, even before hardly any of these channels came into being. So appreciate that. But one of the recent people who have been added to it is Tucker Carlson. And he did not hesitate to use his platform to say this.
The entire House of Representatives, every Republican but seven today, minutes ago, just voted to merge the U.S. military, the $1.5 trillion a year U.S. military with the tiny reserve force IDF. Does that help us? No, of course it helps them. Merge American intelligence, the 19 intel agencies, with Mossad. What? Of course. Basically a humiliation ritual. Whatever you want, Israel. If it hurts us, that's fine. Actually, it feels good to sacrifice for you. It's like everyone in the entire government is Mike Huckabee now.
I think that his last comment there is kind of reminiscent of what you just said a minute ago about the true believers. They actually think, yeah, those are one and the same. Their interests and our interests are identical. So to help them is to help us.
Right. And that's why I always, you know, want to caution, you know, the overemphasis on the Israel lobby. And it certainly is important. It is so important. Like, that money does not lie. But also, too, if you go and meet with these members of Congress, if you go and meet with their staffs, they really do believe this. They are Zionists. Joe Biden, you know, President of the United States, self-described biggest Zionist in Washington, D.C. The man is a true believer. He really did believe that the United States' interests in the Middle East were through Israel, that Israel served American interests as opposed to the other way around. And you'll see it as well, too. If you go to Israel, you'll see the commentary being that Israel is controlled by the U.S. So if you ever you'll see protests coming out of Israel. You know, we saw protests coming out of Israel when Israel agreed or when the ceasefire with Iran was announced and the MOU was established, and this MOU called for Israel to end its war in Lebanon and to withdraw. And the protests against that from the Israeli public, because the invasion of an occupation of Lebanon by Israel is incredibly popular in Israel. So the protests against the potential ceasefire in Lebanon, you know, there are people with Trump and Netanyahu masks on, and it's Trump who's holding Netanyahu on a leash, right? And if you came here, you'd see the reverse. So I think it's important people understand that there are real priorities here, real interests at play, or at least perceived real interests and priorities that go beyond the corruption of the Israel lobby, the corruption of America's, organized, bribery network that we have as a government. You know, and the other thing, one thing I want to bring up, because this is so important, is because people will say about this integration, well, we have this with other states. You know, after World War II, we established the Five Eyes program, and the Five Eyes program is the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand, and they share intelligence. But that's very limited. And we also have treaties with these countries. So we have a technological exchange treaty with the United Kingdom That's an actual treaty. That's something that has based upon ratification by our Congress. And actually, as someone, when I hit procurement, Danny, in 08, when I was working at JIDO, the Joint IED Defeat Organization, we were trying to find suicide bombers. We had the Brits come over and they brought some of their stuff, some of their X-ray things and, you know, thermal images and everything else to see what they were working on. And it was such a pain in the neck. Even though we had these agreements, even though we had this treaty, even though we were supposed to share, you know, secret level information, this wasn't TS level, this was secret level information. It was such a pain in the neck, it was almost not worth it. You know, and then you know as well from all the time you're involved with classified information, what's the most common classification marking you'll find is no foreigners. You know, when I was with Second Marines in Iraq, we had a Royal Marine as our assistant operations officer. The regimental assistant operations officer was a Royal Marine. It's an exchange program that went back to, you know, God knows when. And the problem being is that now we're at war, we're in Iraq, and this guy's not allowed to see anything. It wasn't a real problem. You know, it was a very real problem. And they had workarounds, and I'm sure there are things he saw that he wasn't supposed to see. But again, he's the regimental opso. And, you know, we're in this fight against, you know, the Sunni insurgency, or assistant opso. But yeah, I mean, so all these arguments trying to justify it, all of these analogies to other things, it's all specious. It's all specious. There is nothing at all like what we're seeing here with this Section 219 from the House and then Section 1217 from the Senate. And I will also, well, I guess, probably should talk about the executive agent. So what Section 219 does is create an executive agent. And you have executive agents in government when you have, you know, more than one institution or organization involved. You create an executive agent to oversee the process, right? To manage the program, right? So if one agency says one thing and another organization says another, you've got somebody who is managing that conflict there and determining outcomes. And so it makes sense in a bureaucratic setting. In this case, the executive agent is going to be only able to be overridden by the Secretary of Defense or by the United States President. This executive agent will have the power within the Department of Defense to rule on anything and everything regarding Israel. So if I can't remember the name of the actual organization, the Defense Technology Transfer Board or whoever the heck they are, right? The folks who say this thing is too sensitive to send overseas to give to our allies. Well, this executive agent can say, well, I don't care. We're going to give it to Israel. And no one can do anything about it except for the Secretary of Defense or the American president.
And listen, so give me some optimism here. And this is going to sound
I don't got it in me.
Help me out here. Let me finish the sentence at least so that you can pretend like you're going to give me some good news. Even my good news here, the setup for it is going to sound like it's the opposite. But in the environment to where, and we haven't even talked anything about the current situation with the Iran war and where that may be going, and it could be about to explode. Strait of Hormuz, the Bab al-Mandab, that shut down, the price of oil is going up, all kinds of problems. We can't get to their bases. We can't do anything against them, et cetera. And this could be expanding. President Trump has given serious consideration to expanding. If he keeps going down this path, then this war that we started because Israel wanted us to, and it was never about nuclear weapons, it was never about any of that stuff, only what Israel wanted. And if it turns out that we actually lose the war, we've already cost us tremendous amounts in the troops and the bases and the money that I've talked about. But if we actually lose the war and Trump is able, we run out of missiles, for example, and now that we have to withdraw in shame and humiliation, is it possible that we could finally say, okay, we have to disentangle from Israel because it's costing our own country something we can't afford. Is there any possibility of that, or is that it? Even if our country burns and sinks like the Titanic, we're going to stay like this.
I think that the American empire is so well established. There are such fortunes made both by corporations, institutions, individuals, that even a defeat like this is not going to see sense coming to American foreign policy. I mean, we saw this, Danny, was it 2019 when Trump started talking about getting out of Afghanistan? You know, this, we'll stick on Afghanistan as another example here. And the hysteria in Washington, D.C. You remember that, the hysteria. And then, of course, you had the fake stories about the Russians paying the Taliban bounties to kill American soldiers. And it just came up with all types of preposterous claims and reasons why the United States had to stay in Afghanistan forever. So even losing something as relatively small as Afghanistan in terms of the money it was bringing in and just the fact that the branches didn't even want to be there. The only people that want to be there, I guess, was probably SOCOM, right? But the Army wanted to go to Europe. The Navy and the Air Force wanted to go to pivot to Asia, you know? So, you know, so you see that and you see just how entrenched, how established the interests are here. Again, it's an ecosystem. And the idea of changing that ecosystem, you get draining the swamp, if you will. You know, I mean, that's what you're up against. You're up against trying to fundamentally alter the structure of the American empire. But we've seen people understand it, though. And we saw aspects of this in Donald Trump's national security strategy. So we go back to November or December, whenever that was released. And, you know, that national security strategy calls for reorientating the American footprint abroad. Less presence, less involvement in Europe, less presence, less involvement in the Middle East, stronger, much stronger focus on the Western Hemisphere, and a greater positioning towards Asia. And so I don't know if I don't agree with that, but I can understand it because it makes sense. There's an argument to be made supporting that type of strategy. But here you see they can't even hold to that. They can't, you know, they're now I'm hearing this morning about possibly the United States getting involved in Mali. I guess if the French couldn't do it and the Russians couldn't do it, why don't we give it a shot? You know, I mean, so, you know, you can have these sensibilities appearing. You can have people in power saying, you know what, the best thing for us to do is start to stop being overextended, right? You're in a hole. Best thing to do is stop digging. You know, I mean, at least that level of sense sometimes appears, but it gets shut down because everyone's making their money off of the hole being dug, right? I mean, so to change it all around is very difficult. What's the inducement? What's the incentive? You know, I think, you know, people, I get this question. I'm sure you get this as well. And you almost had a shot to get into the government, but most of the folks that you're having come on your program, you know, who've been right about this, that, the other thing, they're not getting called to come into the government. They're not getting called by any of these Beltway bandits to say, you know, hey, Larry Wilkerson or hey, Larry Johnson, you know, it would be great if you led our red team. You know, that's not happening, right? I mean, because the system is set up not based upon reality. It's not based upon success. It's based upon narrative. And the narrative is that of the American exceptionalism about the benevolence of the American empire. And that will continue. And that's how people get rich.
Okay, you're right. That's not optimistic.
no, I'm sorry. I wish I could. You know,
to listen to you. And I mean, this is a Thursday afternoon, so why not take one more bite of the apple of disappointing me? Congress, you and I have for many, many years, well over a decade, lamented that the erosion, it started off as just erosion between Article 1 and Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution mm-hmm. in terms of the who can take the U.S. to war, whether it's the president or the Congress. Obviously, it was clearly the Congress. It's explicitly stated so. But all these presidents from Clinton on forward, Bush, obviously in a big way, even Obama in some smaller ways, everybody has done that. Well, then the 1973 War Powers Act, which was supposed to clarify the division of powers in there, was never fully executed or even followed. Now that it's a complete dead letter, there's none whatsoever. They don't have it. Nevertheless, Congress, I don't know why, maybe you can give me your view here. The House of Representatives voted earlier, I think today, to limit Iran war for the first time since the ceasefire breakdown, but as you were telling me just before we came on the air here, it didn't survive long because it went to the Senate. And what happened?
And the Senate voted it down. I think the Senate voted it down 49 to 47. I haven't seen the breakout, but I did hear that two Republicans voted for the War Powers Resolution in the Senate. I'm assuming John Fetterman voted against it. Yeah, I mean, what makes no sense, as you and I were talking about this, is that the House and Senate passed a version of the War Powers Resolution, you know, several weeks ago, you know, a month or so ago. And so there's a concurrent resolution from the U.S. House and U.S. Senate that under the War Powers Resolution has the authority of law. Now, I personally don't agree with that. I don't think that's possible for a concurrent resolution to have the force of law. It needs the president's signature. There's no other examples of concurrent resolutions that have carried that weight of law, but it's never been adjudicated. So why is the Congress, and in this case, the Democrats, why are the Democrats just offering up more votes on this, probably knowing that this vote wasn't going to get passed, probably knowing it wasn't going to get through the Senate? Why are they doing that rather than taking the administration to court? Why aren't they filing, an injunction against the war, essentially, and at least adjudicating it?
Because that previous measure, correct me if I'm wrong, it said that if President Trump wanted to go back to do anything in Iran, he had to first get authorization from the Congress, meaning that if he's considering right now, which the news says he is, another big return to war. And actually, we're already in it. We're right on day 12. So we're basically already in it. What am I talking about? Not basically. We are already back in it. So there is a foundation to take that existing legislation and say, let's go take it to court because it's not being followed.
That's right. And then you would have, I think there's a couple things. One, the Democrats simply want to be performative. They want to just stage votes, whether they win the votes or not. They want to get the sound bites. They want to get the video clips. They want to have what they think might be ammunition for them to use against their Republican opponents in November. But no real interest in ending it, right? No real interest in ending it. We saw that yesterday when the House representative passed the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which provides all the funding that this government needs to carry out its wars. And if they do attack Mali, Mali will be the eighth country that President Trump has attacked in the last 16 months or 17 months or however. So despite all their grandstanding, the NDAA passes with 6 Democratic votes. And anyone who knows anything about Congress knows that those 6 votes were all authorized by House Democratic leadership, with the exception of a couple of those votes. I can't imagine they would have been allowed to vote that way if Hakeem Jeffries and Catherine Clark and others didn't tell them that they could. So this is very performative. The other aspect of it, too, there may be some, they don't want to go to court because they're afraid that the War Powers Resolution might get ruled unconstitutional. And then not only would they lose in court, they would also lose the performative measure. And then, my God, they might actually have to legislate something that is constitutional that would check the president's powers, right? You know, would force the president to follow the Constitution. My God, can you think of that? You know, they don't want to do that. So I think that's what we're dealing with here. Just this desire to perform as opposed to actually do something of function. And yeah, it'll be very similar to, and we'll see what happens in November if they get into power, if the Democrats do anything about this war. I think it'll be very similar to 2006 when the Democrats take power in the Congress and, you know, George W. Bush lies us into the Iraq War, kills thousands of Americans, wounds tens of thousands more for life, kills 1 million Iraqis, criminal great war crime, also incredibly counterproductive for the United States of America. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, takes impeachment off the table. And so I'm thinking the same thing will occur if the Democrats take power in November, that they'll just continue to perform and they want to see the war go on because they feel it's better politically for them to have $4 a gallon gasoline in the U.S., you know, heading towards 5 by the end of the summer, the idea of inflation rearing its head again here in the United States, supply shortages in the supermarket, all those types of things. I think the Democrats think that's better for them electorally in November. They'll go from there.
In the remainder of the time, I wonder if you can kind of let us know what you think the potential ramifications are of this. You've laid out the ecosystem. You've laid out the likely course of action, what people will probably do no matter the realities on the battlefield. But one of my biggest worries is that this continuing to shred the foundations of our power and of the balance of power, the guardrails that have been up, is that we are have basically already established a situation to where there is a presidential monarch, if that's a term I think I can use, that now that is above the law, nearly any law, but certainly that he now has unilateral power to do anything with the armed forces that he wants to do. And I haven't seen any limits at all. And with these mm-hmm. kinds of votes, it seems to that we're now going to be in a situation to where there is literally an imperial monarch that determines whether we go to war, which is a radical violation of the foundation of our country. Is that something that can just persist and is actually kind of like no big deal? Or do you think that there's going to be a problem with it in the future?
Oh, I think it's going to be a worsening and worsening problem. That this, I don't think there's going to be one catastrophe, Danny, that ends the American empire, but it's going to be the continual bankrupting of the United States, then the continued underinvestment in the United States. So that as we continue to spend trillions of dollars on war, we continue to cut our social services, our investment in our own economy, our investment in our infrastructure. We have a sicker, less educated population. All those things of a rotting country. And coupled with that, then I think you start to have real fiscal problems in the sense that as your debt goes higher, your dollar starts to lose value and your interest rates go up. And then with that declining value in the dollar, this nation of importers, because we don't manufacture anything, we're dealing with very severe inflation and interest rates are going up. So that this idea of stagflation as the years go on becomes almost a common occurrence in the United States, because we're spending $1.5 to $2 trillion a year on our military. We're spending an equivalent amount on interest payments on the debt, and we're not investing in ourselves. We're not growing our economy or not. We're not taking care of our people. And so I think that's how the American empire eventually collapses. But there's other things too here we can point to. Let's go back to this integration with the Israeli army. We've seen this. I'm sure you guys have been talking about this a lot, the repositioning of American forces into Israel, right? So go back before February, there were what, two small American bases in Israel. That was basically it. And now coming out of this, regardless, there's going to be a heavy American military presence in Israel going forward. We're going to have fighter squadrons there on rotations. AWACS planes will be stationed there, et cetera, et cetera. There'll probably be like a brigade combat team stationed there going forward or something. That means then that anything the Israelis do will be tied to the Americans. So that any attack on the Israeli military, because the U.S. military is co-located with them in Israel, it will now be an issue of self-defense for the U.S. military. So if, say, Hezbollah strikes an Israeli airbase that you also have a rotating squadron of F-16s at, now you have an attack on the U.S. military as well. Now you have the U.S. military launching operations against Hezbollah, et cetera. And you can pick whatever scenarios you want here. So I think that's a real issue, is that, again, we talked about the American empire being overextended, and that's obvious. And when you keep overextending it, though, you start running into these problems. Again, now, I got to read this thing this morning about we're considering going to war in Mali. Really? We're going to jump into that quicksand? At some point, this farce in Venezuela is going to collapse. I can't see how long that government stays in power for, with the United States stealing all its money. What's it got? Another 6 months, another year, 2 years before something shakes loose there. And there's very real problems. They're on borrowed time there as well. I mean, all these things. And then, of course, if you and I were to, if I was to drive up there and we were going to D.C. and we decided to really hurt ourselves and go to Heritage briefings or CNAS briefings or CISI briefings, what would we hear about? War with China, war with China, war with China, right? So that might be the thing that actually does. I said, I don't see one cataclysmic event, but that might be it. That might be the thing that really undoes the American empire.
Well, it'll all be self-inflicted whenever that happens, and we're going to continue to be miserated as a population every day in between now and then, but that's where we are until we finally hit rock bottom and maybe more people rise up and finally are able to take control of this. We just have to hope and pray that that day comes. But in any case, we appreciate you coming on today, and we got to know the nature of the problem first before we can fix it, and that's what we've done here, and I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys, too. We will see you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.